Chapter 13. The Vigil. Sir James brushed past Julius and hurriedly bent over the fallen woman.
"Hurt," he said sharply. "Seeing us so suddenly must have given her a shock. Brandy, and quickly, or she'll slip through our fingers."
Julius hurried to the washstand.
"Not there," said Tuppence over her shoulder. "In the tantalus in the dining room, second door down the passage."
Between them, Sir James and Tuppence lifted Mrs. Vandermeer and carried her to the bed. There they dashed water on her face, but with no result. The lawyer fingered her pulse.
"Touch and go," he muttered. "I wish that young fellow would hurry up with the brandy."
At that moment, Julius re-entered the room, carrying a glass half full of the spirit, which he handed to Sir James. While Tuppence lifted her head, the lawyer tried to force a little of the spirit between her closed lips. Finally, the woman opened her eyes feebly. Tuppence held the glass to her lips.
"Drink this."
Mrs. Vandermeer complied. The brandy brought the colour back to her white cheeks and revived her in a marvellous fashion. She tried to sit up, then fell back with a groan, her hand to her side.
"It's my heart," she whispered. "I mustn't talk."
She lay back with closed eyes. Sir James kept his finger on her wrist a minute longer, then withdrew it with a nod.
"She'll do now."
All three moved away and stood together talking in low voices. One and all were conscious of a certain feeling of anticlimax. Clearly any scheme for cross-questioning the lady was out of the question for the moment. For the time being they were baffled and could do nothing.
Tuppence related how Mrs. Vandermeer had declared herself willing to disclose the identity of Mr. Brown, and how she had consented to discover and reveal to them the whereabouts of Jane Finn. Julius was congratulatory.
"That's all right, Miss Tuppence. Splendid. I guess that £100,000 will look just as good in the morning to the lady as it did overnight. There's nothing to worry over. She won't speak without the cash anyway, you bet."
There was certainly a good deal of common sense in this, and Tuppence felt a little comforted.
"What you say is true," said Sir James meditatively. "I must confess, however, that I cannot help wishing we had not interrupted at the minute we did. Still, it cannot be helped. It is only a matter of waiting until the morning."
He looked across at the inert figure on the bed. Mrs. Vandermeer lay, perfectly passive, with closed eyes. He shook his head.
"Well," said Tuppence, with an attempt at cheerfulness, "we must wait until the morning, that's all. But I don't think we ought to leave the flat."
"What about leaving that bright boy of yours on guard?"
"Albert. And suppose she came round again and hooked it? Albert couldn't stop her."
"I guess she won't want to make tracks away from the dollars."
"She might. She seemed very frightened of Mr. Brown."
"What? Real plumb scared of him?"
"Yes. She looked round and said even walls had ears."
"Maybe she meant a dictaphone," said Julius with interest. "Miss Tuppence is right," said Sir James quietly. "We must not leave the flat, if only for Mrs. Vandermeer's sake."
Julius stared at him.
"You think he'd get after her? Between now and tomorrow morning? How could he know, even?" "You forget your own suggestion of a dictaphone," said Sir James dryly. "We have a very formidable adversary. I believe, if we exercise all due care, that there is a very good chance of his being delivered into our hands. But we must neglect no precaution. We have an important witness, but she must be safeguarded. I would suggest that Miss Tuppence should go to bed, and that you and I, Mr. Hersheimer, should share the vigil."
Tuppence was about to protest, but happening to glance at the bed, she saw Mrs. Vandermeer, her eyes half open, with such an expression of mingled fear and malevolence on her face that it quite froze the words on her lips. For a moment she wondered whether the faint and the heart attack had been a gigantic sham, but remembering the deadly pallor she could hardly credit the supposition. As she looked, the expression disappeared as by magic, and Mrs. Vandermeer lay inert and motionless as before. For a moment the girl fancied she must have dreamt it, but she determined nevertheless to be on the alert.
"Well," said Julius, "I guess we'd better make a move out of here, anyway."
The others fell in with his suggestion. Sir James again felt Mrs. Vandermeer's pulse.
"Perfectly satisfactory," he said in a low voice to Tuppence. "She'll be absolutely all right after a night's rest."
The girl hesitated a moment by the bed. The intensity of the expression she had surprised had impressed her powerfully. Mrs. Vandermeer lifted her lids. She seemed to be struggling to speak. Tuppence bent over her.
"Don't leave."
She seemed unable to proceed, murmuring something that sounded like sleepy. Then she tried again. Tuppence bent lower. It was only a breath.
"Mr. Brown."
The voice stopped. But the half-closed eyes seemed still to send an agonized message. Moved by a sudden impulse, the girl said quickly,
"I shan't leave the flat. I shall sit up all night."
A flash of relief showed before the lids descended once more. Apparently Mrs. Vandermeer slept. But her words had awakened a new uneasiness in Tuppence. What had she meant by that low murmur, "Mr. Brown"? Tuppence caught herself, nervously looking over her shoulder. The big wardrobe loomed up in a sinister fashion before her eyes. Plenty of room for a man to hide in that. Half ashamed of herself, Tuppence pulled it open and looked inside. No one, of course. She stooped down and looked under the bed. There was no other possible hiding place. Tuppence gave her familiar shake of the shoulders. It was absurd, this giving way to nerves. Slowly she went out of the room. Julius and Sir James were talking in a low voice. Sir James turned to her.
"Lock the door on the outside, please, Miss Tuppence, and take out the key. There must be no chance of anyone entering that room."
The gravity of his manner impressed them, and Tuppence felt less ashamed of her attack of nerves.
"Say," remarked Julius suddenly, "there's Tuppence's bright boy. I guess I'd better go down and ease his young mind. That's some lad, Tuppence."
"How did you get in, by the way?" asked Tuppence suddenly. "I forgot to ask."
"Well, Albert got me on the phone, all right. I ran round for Sir James here, and we came right on. The boy was on the lookout for us, and was just a mite worried about what might have happened to you. He'd been listening outside the door of the flat, but couldn't hear anything. Anyhow, he suggested sending us up in the coal lift instead of ringing the bell. And sure enough, we landed in the scullery and came right along to find you. Albert's still below, and must be just hopping mad by this time."
With which Julius departed abruptly.
"Now then, Miss Tuppence," said Sir James, "you know this place better than I do. Where do you suggest we should take up our quarters?"
Tuppence considered for a moment or two.
"I think Mrs. Vandermeer's boudoir would be the most comfortable," she said at last, and led the way there.
Sir James looked round approvingly. "Oh, this will do very well. And now, my dear young lady, do go to bed and get some sleep."
Tuppence shook her head resolutely.
"I couldn't, thank you, Sir James. I should dream of Mr. Brown all night."
"But you'll be so tired, child."
"No, I shan't. I'd rather stay up, really."
The lawyer gave in. Julius reappeared some minutes later, having reassured Albert and rewarded him lavishly for his services. Having, in his turn, failed to persuade Tuppence to go to bed, he said decisively,
"At any rate, you've got to have something to eat right away. Where's the larder?"
Tuppence directed him, and he returned in a few minutes with a cold pie and three plates. After a hearty meal, the girl felt inclined to pooh-pooh her fancies of half an hour before. The power of the money bribe could not fail.
"And now, Miss Tuppence," said Sir James, "we want to hear your adventures."
"That's so," agreed Julius.
Tuppence narrated her adventures with some complacence. Julius occasionally interjected an admiring, "Bully!" Sir James said nothing until she had finished, when his quiet,
"Well done, Miss Tuppence,"
made her flush with pleasure.
"There's one thing I don't get clearly," said Julius. "What put her up to clearing out?"
"I don't know," confessed Tuppence.
Sir James stroked his chin thoughtfully.
"The room was in great disorder. That looks as though her flight was unpremeditated, almost as though she got a sudden warning to go from someone."
"Mr. Brown, I suppose," said Julius scoffingly.
The lawyer looked at him deliberately for a minute or two.
"Why not?" he said. "Remember, you yourself have once been worsted by him."
Julius flushed with vexation.
I feel just mad when I think of how I handed out Jane's photograph to him like a lamb. Gee, if I ever lay hands on it again, I'll freeze onto it like hell.
That contingency is likely to be a remote one, said the other dryly.
I guess you're right, said Julius frankly. And in any case, it's the original I'm out after. Where do you think she can be, Sir James?
The lawyer shook his head.
Impossible to say, but I've a very good idea where she has been.
You have? Where?
Sir James smiled.
At the scene of your nocturnal adventures, the Bournemouth nursing home.
There? Impossible. I asked.
No, my dear sir, you asked if anyone of the name of Jane Finn had been there. Now, if the girl had been placed there, it would almost certainly be under an assumed name.
Bully for you, cried Julius. I never thought of that.
It was fairly obvious, said the other.
Perhaps the doctor's in it too, suggested Tuppence.
Julius shook his head. I don't think so. I talked to him at once. No, I'm pretty sure Dr. Hall's all right.
Hall, did you say? Asked Sir James.
That is curious. Really very curious.
Why? Demanded Tuppence.
Because I happened to meet him this morning. I've known him slightly on and off for some years, and this morning I ran across him in the street, staying at the Metropole, he told me.
He turned to Julius.
Didn't he tell you he was coming up to town?
Julius shook his head.
Curious, mused Sir James. You did not mention his name this afternoon, or I would have suggested your going to him for further information with my card as introduction.
I guess I'm a mutt, said Julius, with unusual humility. I ought to have thought of the false name stunt.
How could you think of anything after falling out of that tree? Cried Tuppence. I'm sure anyone else would have been killed right off.
Well, I guess it doesn't matter now, anyway, said Julius. We've got Mrs. Vandermeer on a string, and that's all we need.
Yes, said Tuppence,
but there was a lack of assurance in her voice.
A silence settled down over the party. Little by little, the magic of the night began to gain a hold on them. There were sudden creaks in the furniture, imperceptible rustlings in the curtains. Suddenly, Tuppence sprang up with a cry.
I can't help it. I know Mr. Brown's somewhere in the flat. I can feel him.
Sure, Tuppence, how could he be? This door is open into the hall. No one could have come in by the front door without our seeing and hearing him.
I can't help it. I feel he's here.
She looked appealingly at Sir James, who replied gravely,
With due deference to your feelings, Miss Tuppence, and mine as well for that matter, I do not see how it is humanly possible for anyone to be in the flat without our knowledge.
The girl was a little comforted by his words.
Sitting up at night is always rather jumpy, she confessed.
Yes, said Sir James, we are in the condition of people holding a séance. Perhaps if a medium were present, we might get some marvellous results.
Do you believe in spiritualism? Asked Tuppence, opening her eyes wide.
The lawyer shrugged his shoulders.
There is some truth in it, without a doubt, but most of the testimony would not pass muster in the witness box.
The hours drew on. With the first faint glimmerings of dawn, Sir James drew aside the curtains. They beheld what few Londoners see, the slow rising of the sun over the sleeping city. Somehow, with the coming of the light, the dreads and fancies of the past night seemed absurd. Tuppence's spirits revived to the normal.
"Hooray!" she said. "It's going to be a gorgeous day, and we shall find Tommy and Jane Finn, and everything will be lovely. I shall ask Mr. Carter if I can't be made a dame."
At 7 o'clock, Tuppence volunteered to go and make some tea. She returned with a tray containing the teapot and 4 cups.
"Who's the other cup for?" inquired Julius.
"The prisoner, of course. I suppose we might call her that."
"Taking her tea seems a kind of anticlimax to last night," said Julius thoughtfully.
"Yes, it does," admitted Tuppence. "But anyway, here goes. Perhaps you'd both come too, in case she springs on me or anything. You see, we don't know what mood she'll wake up in."
Sir James and Julius accompanied her to the door.
"Where's the key? Oh, of course, I've got it myself."
She put it in the lock and turned it, then paused.
"Supposing, after all, she's escaped," she murmured in a whisper.
"Plum impossible,"
replied Julius reassuringly. But Sir James said nothing. Tuppence drew a long breath and entered. She heaved a sigh of relief as she saw that Mrs. Vandermeer was lying on the bed.
"Good morning," she remarked cheerfully. "I brought you some tea."
Mrs. Vandermeer did not reply. Tuppence put down the cup on the table by the bed and went across to draw up the blinds. When she turned, Mrs. Vandermeer still lay without a movement. With a sudden fear clutching at her heart, Tuppence ran to the bed. The hand she lifted was cold as ice. Mrs. Vandermeer would never speak now. Her cry brought the others. A very few minutes sufficed. Mrs. Vandermeer was dead, must have been dead some hours. She had evidently died in her sleep.
"If that isn't the cruelest luck!" cried Julius in despair.
The lawyer was calmer, but there was a curious gleam in his eyes.
"If it is luck," he replied.
"You don't think... but say that's plumb impossible. No one could have got in."
"No," admitted the lawyer, "I don't see how they could. And yet she is on the point of betraying Mr. Brown, and she dies. Is it only chance?"
"But how—"
"Yes, how? That is what we must find out."
He stood there silently, gently stroking his chin.
"We must find out," he said quietly,
and Tuppence felt that if she was Mr. Brown she would not like the tone of those simple words. Julius's glance went to the window.
"The window's open," he remarked. "Do you think—"
Tuppence shook her head.
"The balcony only goes along as far as the boudoir. We were there."
"He might have slipped out," suggested Julius.
But Sir James interrupted him.
"Mr. Brown's methods are not so crude. In the meantime, we must send for a doctor, but before we do so, is there anything in this room that might be of value to us?"
Hastily, the three searched. A charred mass in the grate indicated that Mrs. Vandermeer had been burning papers on the eve of her flight. Nothing of importance remained, though they searched the other rooms as well.
"There's that," said Tuppence, suddenly, pointing to a small old-fashioned safe let into the wall. "It's for jewellery, I believe, but there might be something else in it."
The key was in the lock, and Julius swung open the door and searched inside. He was some time over the task.
"Well?" said Tuppence impatiently.
There was a pause before Julius answered. Then he withdrew his head and shut to the door.
"Nothing," he said.
In 5 minutes a brisk young doctor arrived, hastily summoned. He was deferential to Sir James, whom he recognised.
"Heart failure, or possibly an overdose of some sleeping draught," he sniffed. "Rather an odour of chloral in the air."
Tuppence remembered the glass she had upset. A new thought drove her to the washstand. She found the little bottle from which Mrs. Vandermeer had poured a few drops. It had been three parts full. Now it was empty. Chapter 14. A Consultation. Nothing was more surprising and bewildering to Tuppence than the ease and simplicity with which everything was arranged, owing to Sir James's skilful handling. The doctor accepted quite readily the theory that Mrs. Vandermeer had accidentally taken an overdose of chloral. He doubted whether an inquest would be necessary. If so, he would let Sir James know. He understood that Mrs. Vandermeer was on the eve of departure for abroad, and that the servants had already left. Sir James and his young friends had been paying a call upon her when she was suddenly stricken down, and they had spent the night in the flat, not liking to leave her alone. Did they know of any relatives? They did not, but Sir James referred him to Mrs. Vandermeer's solicitor. Shortly afterwards a nurse arrived to take charge, and the others left the ill-omened building.
"And what now?" asked Julius with a gesture of despair. "I guess we're down and out for good."
Sir James stroked his chin thoughtfully.
"No," he said quietly, "there is still the chance that Dr. Hall may be able to tell us something. Gee, I'd forgotten him. The chance is slight, but it must not be neglected. I think I told you that he is staying at the Metropole. I should suggest that we call upon him there as soon as possible. Shall we say, after a bath and breakfast?"
It was arranged that Tuppence and Julius should return to the Ritz and call for Sir James in the car. This programme was faithfully carried out, and a little after 11 they drew up before the Metropole. They asked for Dr. Hall, and a page-boy went in search of him.
In a few minutes the little doctor came hurrying towards them. "Can you spare us a few minutes, Dr. Hall?" said Sir James pleasantly. "Let me introduce you to Miss Cowley. Mr. Hirschheimer, I think you already know."
A quizzical gleam came into the doctor's eye as he shook hands with Julius.
"Ah, yes, my young friend of the tree episode. Ankle all right, eh?" "I guess it's cured, owing to your skilful treatment, Doc. And the heart trouble, "Still searching," said Julius briefly. "To come to the point, can we have a word with you in private?" asked Sir James. "Certainly. I think there is a room here where we shall be quite undisturbed."
He led the way, and the others followed him. They sat down, and the doctor looked inquiringly at Sir James.
"Dr. Hall, I'm very anxious to find a certain young lady for the purpose of obtaining a statement from her. I have reason to believe that she has been at one time or another in your establishment at Bournemouth. I hope I am transgressing no professional etiquette in questioning you on the subject. I suppose it is a matter of testimony."
Sir James hesitated a moment, then he replied,
"Yes. I shall be pleased to give you any information in my power. What is the young lady's name? Mr. Hirschheimer asked me, I remember."
He half turned to Julius.
"The name," said Sir James bluntly, "is really immaterial. She would be almost certainly sent to you under an assumed one. But I should like to know if you are acquainted with a Mrs. Vandermeer."
"Mrs. Vandermeer of 20 South Audley Mansions? I know her slightly."
"You are not aware of what has happened?"
"What do you mean?"
"You do not know that Mrs. Vandermeer is dead?"
"Dear, dear, I had no idea of it. When did it happen?"
"She took an overdose of chloral last night."
"Purposely?"
"Accidentally, it is believed. I should not like to say myself. Anyway, she was found dead this morning."
"Very sad. A singularly handsome woman. I presume she was a friend of yours, since you are acquainted with all these details?"
"I am acquainted with the details because, well, it was I who found her dead."
"Indeed?" said the doctor, starting.
"Yes," said Sir James, and stroked his chin reflectively.
"This is very sad news. But you will excuse me if I say that I do not see how it bears on the subject of your inquiry."
"It bears on it in this way. Is it not a fact that Mrs. Vandermeer committed a young relative of hers to your charge?"
Julius leaned forward eagerly.
"That is the case," said the doctor quietly. "Under the name of Janet Vandermeer, I understood her to be a niece of Mrs. Vandermeer's."
"And she came to you?"
"As far as I can remember, in June or July of 1915.
"Was she a mental case?"
"She is perfectly sane, if that is what you mean. I understood from Mrs. Vandermeer that the girl had been with her on the Lusitania when that ill-fated ship was sunk, and had suffered a severe shock in consequence."
"We're on the right track, I think."
Sir James looked round.
"As I said before, I'm a mutt," returned Julius.
The doctor looked at them all curiously.
"You spoke of wanting a statement from her," he said. "Supposing she is not able to give one?"
"What? You have just said that she is perfectly sane."
"So she is. Nevertheless, if you want a statement from her concerning any events prior to May 7, 1915, she will not be able to give it to you."
They looked at the little man, stupefied.
He nodded cheerfully. "It's a pity," he said, "a great pity, especially as I gather, Sir James, that the matter is important. But there it is. She can tell you nothing."
"But why, man? Darn it all, why?"
The little man shifted his benevolent glance to the excited young American.
"Because Janet Vandermeer is suffering from a complete loss of memory."
"What?"
"Quite so, an interesting case, a very interesting case. Not so uncommon, really, as you would think. There are several very well-known parallels. It's the first case of the kind that I've had under my own personal observation, and I must admit that I found it of absorbing interest."
There was something rather ghoulish in the little man's satisfaction.
"And she remembers nothing," said Sir James slowly. "Nothing prior to May 7, 1915. After that date, her memory is as good as yours or mine." Then the first thing she remembers
is landing with the survivors. Everything before that is a blank. She did not know her own name, or where she had come from, or where she was. She couldn't even speak her own tongue.
"But surely all this is most unusual," put in Julius.
"No, my dear sir, quite normal, under the circumstances. Severe shock to the nervous system. Loss of memory proceeds nearly always on the same lines. I suggested a specialist, of course. There's a very good man in Paris who makes a study of these cases. But Mrs. Vandermeer opposed the idea of publicity that might result from such a course."
"I can imagine she would," said Sir James grimly.
"I fell in with her views. There is a certain notoriety given to these cases. And the girl was very young, 19, I believe. It seemed a pity that her infirmity should be talked about, might damage her prospects. Besides, there is no special treatment to pursue in such cases. It is really a matter of waiting."
"Waiting?"
"Yes, sooner or later the memory will return, as suddenly as it went. But in all probability the girl will have entirely forgotten the intervening period, and will take up life where she left off at the sinking of the Lusitania."
"And when do you expect this to happen?"
The doctor shrugged his shoulders. "Ah, that I cannot say. Sometimes it is a matter of months. Sometimes it has been known to be as long as 20 years. Sometimes another shock does the trick. One restores what the other took away."
"Another shock, eh?" said Julius thoughtfully.
"Exactly. There was a case in Colorado." The little man's voice trailed on, voluble, mildly enthusiastic. Julius did not seem to be listening. He had relapsed into his own thoughts and was frowning. Suddenly he came out of his brown study and hit the table such a resounding bang with his fist that everyone jumped, the doctor most of all.
"I've got it! I guess, Doc, I'd like your medical opinion on the plan I'm about to outline. Say Jane was to cross the herring pond again, and the same thing was to happen. The submarine, the sinking ship, everyone to take to the boats and so on. Wouldn't that do the trick? Wouldn't it give a mighty big bump to her subconscious self, or whatever the jargon is, and start it functioning again right away?"
"A very interesting speculation, Mr. Hirschheimer. In my own opinion, it would be successful. It is unfortunate that there is no chance of the conditions repeating themselves, as you suggest.
Not by nature, perhaps, Doc, but I'm talking about art."
"Art?
Why, yes, what's the difficulty? Hire a liner?"
"A liner?" murmured Dr. Hall faintly.
"Hire some passengers, hire a submarine. That's the only difficulty, I guess. Governments are apt to be a bit hidebound over their engines of war. They won't sell to the first comer. Still, I guess that can be got over. Ever heard of the word graft, sir? Well, graft gets there every time. I reckon that we shan't really need to fire a torpedo. If everyone hustles round and screams loud enough that the ship is sinking, it ought to be enough for an innocent young girl like Jane. By the time she's got a life-belt on her and is being hustled into a boat, with a well-drilled lot of artistes doing the hysterical stunt on deck, why, she ought to be right back again where she was in May 1915. How's that for the bare outline?"
And Dr. Hall looked at Julius. Everything that he was for the moment incapable of saying was eloquent in that look.
"No," said Julius in answer to it, "I'm not crazy. The thing's perfectly possible. It's done every day in the States for the movies. Haven't you seen trains in collision on the screen? What's the difference between buying up a train and buying up a liner? Get the properties and you can go right ahead."
Dr. Hall found his voice.
"But the expense, my dear sir."
His voice rose.
"The expense! It will be colossal!"
"Money doesn't worry me any," explained Julius simply. Dr. Hall turned an appealing face to Sir James, who smiled slightly. "Mr. Hirschheimer is very well off. Very well off indeed." The doctor's glance came back to Julius with a new and subtle quality in it. This was no longer an eccentric young fellow with the habit of falling off trees. The doctor's eyes held the deference accorded to a really rich man. "Very remarkable plan, huh? Very remarkable," he murmured. "The movies, of course. Your American word for the kinema. Very interesting. I fear we are perhaps a little behind the times over here in our methods. And you really mean to carry out this remarkable plan of yours?"
You bet your bottom dollar I do.
The doctor believed him, which was a tribute to his nationality. If an Englishman had suggested such a thing, he would have had grave doubts as to his sanity.
I cannot guarantee a cure, he pointed out. Perhaps I ought to make that quite clear.
Sure, that's all right, said Julius. You just trot out Jane and leave the rest to me.
Jane?
Miss Janet Vandermeer, then. Can we get on the long distance to your place right away and ask them to send her up, or shall I run down and fetch her in my car?
The doctor stared. I beg your pardon, Mr. Hirschheimer. I thought you understood.
Understood what?
That Miss Vandermeer is no longer under my care.
Chapter 15. Tuppence receives a proposal. Julia sprang up.
What?
I thought you were aware of that.
When did she leave?
Let me see. Today is Monday, is it not? It must have been last Wednesday. Why, surely, yes, it was the same evening that you, fell out of my tree.
That evening? Before or after?
Let me see. Oh, yes, afterwards. A very urgent message arrived from Mrs. Vandermeer. The young lady and the nurse who was in charge of her left by the night train.
Julius sank back again into his chair.
Nurse Edith, left with a patient, I remember, he muttered. My God, to have been so near!
Dr. Hall looked bewildered. I don't understand. Is the young lady not with her aunt, after all?
Tuppence shook her head. She was about to speak, when a warning glance from Sir James made her hold her tongue. The lawyer rose.
Much obliged to you, Hall. We're very grateful for all you've told us. I'm afraid we're now in the position of having to track Miss Vandermeer anew.
What about the nurse who accompanied her? I suppose you don't know where she is.
The doctor shook his head.
We've not heard from her, as it happens. I understood she was to remain with Miss Vandermeer for a while. But what can have happened? Surely the girl has not been kidnapped.
That remains to be seen, said Sir James gravely.
The other hesitated.
You do not think I ought to go to the police?
No, no. In all probability the young lady is with other relations.
The doctor was not completely satisfied, but he saw that Sir James was determined to say no more, and realized that to try and extract more information from the famous K.C. would be mere waste of labor. Accordingly, he wished them good-bye, and they left the hotel. For a few minutes they stood by the car talking.
"How maddening!" cried Tuppence. "To think that Julius must have been actually under the same roof with her for a few hours!"
"I was a darned idiot," muttered Julius gloomily.
"You couldn't know," Tuppence consoled him. "Could he?"
she appealed to Sir James.
"I should advise you not to worry," said the latter kindly. "No use crying over spilt milk, you know."
"The great thing is what to do next,"
added Tuppence the practical. Sir James shrugged his shoulders.
"You might advertise for the nurse who accompanied the girl. That is the only course I can suggest, and I must confess I do not hope for much result. Otherwise there is nothing to be done."
"Nothing?" said Tuppence blankly. "And Tommy?"
"We must hope for the best," said Sir James. "Oh, yes, we must go on hoping."
But over her downcast head his eyes met Julius's, and almost imperceptibly he shook his head. Julius understood. The lawyer considered the case hopeless. The young American's face grew grave. Sir James took Tuppence's hand.
"You must let me know if anything further comes to light. Letters will always be forwarded."
Tuppence stared at him blankly.
"You're going away?"
"I told you, don't you remember? To Scotland."
"Yes, but I thought—"
The girl hesitated.
Sir James shrugged his shoulders. "My dear young lady, I can do nothing more, I fear. Our clues have all ended in thin air. You can take my word for it that there is nothing more to be done. If anything should arise, I shall be glad to advise you in any way I can."
His words gave Tuppence an extraordinarily desolate feeling.
"I suppose you're right," she said. "Anyway, thank you very much for trying to help us. Good-bye."
Julius was bending over the car.
A momentary pity came into Sir James's keen eyes as he gazed into the girl's downcast face. "Don't be too disconsolate, Miss Tuppence," he said in a low voice. "Remember, holiday time isn't always all playtime. One sometimes manages to put in some work as well." Something in his tone made Tuppence glance up sharply. He shook his head with a smile. "No, I shan't say any more. Great mistake to say too much. Remember that. Never tell all you know, not even to the person you know best. Understand? Goodbye." He strode away. Tuppence stared after him. She was beginning to understand Sir James's methods. Once before he had thrown her a hint in the same careless fashion. Was this a hint? What exactly lay behind those last brief words? Did he mean that after all he had not abandoned the case? That secretly he would be working on it still while... Her meditations were interrupted by Julius, who adjured her to get right in. "You're looking kind of thoughtful," he remarked as they started off. "Did the old guy say anything more?" Tuppence opened her mouth impulsively and then shut it again. Sir James's words sounded in her ears. "Never tell all you know, not even to the person you know best." And like a flash there came into her mind another memory. Julius, before the safe in the flat, her own question, and the pause before his reply, "Nothing." Was there really nothing? Or had he found something he wished to keep to himself? If he could make a reservation, so could she. "Nothing particular," she replied. She felt, rather than saw, Julius throw a sideways glance at her. "Say, shall we go for a spin in the park?"
"If you like."
For a while they ran on under the trees in silence. It was a beautiful day. The keen rush through the air brought a new exhilaration to Tuppence. "Say, Miss Tuppence, do you think I'm ever going to find Jane?" Julia spoke in a discouraged voice. The mood was so alien to him that Tuppence turned and stared at him in surprise. He nodded. "That's so. I'm getting down and out over the business. Sir James today hadn't got any hope at all. I could see that. I don't like him. We don't gee together somehow, but he's pretty cute, and I guess he wouldn't quit if there was any chance of success. Now would he?" Tuppence felt rather uncomfortable, but clinging to her belief that Julius also had withheld something from her, she remained firm.
"He suggested advertising for the nurse," she reminded him.
"Yes, with a forlorn hope flavour into his voice. No, I'm about fed up. I've half a mind to go back to the States right away."
"Oh, no," cried Tuppence. "We've got to find Tommy."
"I sure forgot Beresford," said Julius contritely. "That's so, we must find him. But after... Well, I've been daydreaming ever since I started on this trip, and these dreams are rotten poor business. I'm quit of them. Say, Miss Tuppence, there's something I'd like to ask you."
"Yes."
"You and Beresford. What about it?"
"I don't understand you," replied Tuppence with dignity, adding rather inconsequently, "And anyway, you're wrong."
"Not got a sort of kindly feeling for one another?"
"Certainly not," said Tuppence with warmth. "Tommy and I are friends, nothing more."
"I guess every pair of lovers has said that some time or another," observed Julius.
"Nonsense," snapped Tuppence. "Do I look the sort of girl that's always falling in love with every man she meets?"
"You do not. You look the sort of girl that's mighty often getting fallen in love with."
"Oh," said Tuppence, rather taken aback. "That's a compliment, I suppose."
"Sure. Now let's get down to this. Supposing we never find Beresford and...
"All right, say it. I can face facts. Supposing he's dead. Well?"
"And all this business fiddles out. What are you going to do?"
"I don't know," said Tuppence forlornly.
"You'll be darn lonesome, you poor kid."
"I shall be all right," snapped Tuppence, with her usual resentment of any kind of pity.
"What about marriage?" inquired Julius. "Got any views on the subject?"
"I intend to marry, of course," replied Tuppence. "That is, if..."
She paused, knew a momentary longing to draw back, and then stuck to her guns bravely.
"I can find someone rich enough to make it worth my while.
That's frank, isn't it? I dare say you despise me for it.
I never despise business instinct, said Julius. What particular figure have you in mind?
Figure? Asked Tuppence, puzzled. Do you mean tall or short?
No, sum. Income.
Oh, I haven't quite worked that out.
What about me?
You?
Sure thing.
Oh, I couldn't.
Why not?
I tell you, I couldn't.
Again, why not?
It would seem so unfair.
I don't see anything unfair about it. I call your bluff, that's all. I admire you immensely, Miss Tuppence, more than any girl I've ever met. You're so darn plucky. I'd just love to give you a real rattling good time. Say the word, and we'll run round right away to some high-class jeweller and fix up the ring business.
I can't, gasped Tuppence.
Because of Beresford?
No, no, no!
Well, then?
Tuppence merely continued to shake her head violently.
You can't reasonably expect more dollars than I've got.
Oh, it isn't that, gasped Tuppence with an almost hysterical laugh. But thanking you very much and all that, I think I'd better say no.
I'd be obliged if you'd do me the favour to think it over until tomorrow.
It's no use.
Still, I guess we'll leave it like that.
Very well, said Tuppence meekly. Neither of them spoke again until they reached the Ritz. Tuppence went upstairs to her room. She felt morally battered to the ground after her conflict with Julius's vigorous personality. Sitting down in front of the glass, she stared at her own reflection for some minutes.
"Fool," murmured Tuppence at length, making a grimace. "Little fool. Everything you want, everything you've ever hoped for, and you go and bleat out no like an idiotic little sheep. It's your one chance. Why didn't you take it? Grab it, snatch at it. What more do you want?"
As if in answer to her own question, her eyes fell on a small snapshot of Tommy that stood on her dressing-table in a shabby frame. For a moment she struggled for self-control, and then, abandoning all pretense, she held it to her lips and burst into a fit of sobbing.
"Oh, Tommy! Tommy!" she cried. "I do love you so, and I may never see you again!"
At the end of 5 minutes, Tuppence sat up, blew her nose, and pushed back her hair.
"That's that," she observed sternly. "Let's look facts in the face. I seem to have fallen in love with an idiot of a boy who probably doesn't care two straws about me."
Here she paused.
"Anyway," she resumed, as though arguing with an unseen opponent, "I don't know that he does. He'd never have dared to say so. I've always jumped on sentiment. And here I am, being more sentimental than anybody. What idiots girls are! I've always thought so. I suppose I shall sleep with this photograph under my pillow and dream about him all night. It's dreadful to feel you've been false to your principles."
Tuppence shook her head sadly as she reviewed her backsliding.
"I don't know what to say to Julius, I'm sure. Oh, what a fool I feel! I'll have to say something. He's so American and thorough, he'll insist upon having a reason. I wonder if he did find anything in that safe."
Tuppence's meditations went off on another tack. She reviewed the events of last night carefully and persistently. Somehow they seemed bound up with Sir James's enigmatical words. Suddenly she gave a great start. The colour faded out of her face. Her eyes, fascinated, gazed in front of her, the pupils dilated.
"Impossible," she murmured. "Impossible! I must be going mad even to think of such a thing."
Monstrous! Yet it explained everything. After a moment's reflection, she sat down and wrote a note, weighing each word as she did so. Finally, she nodded her head as though satisfied, and slipped it into an envelope which she addressed to Julius. She went down the passage to his sitting-room and knocked at the door. As she had expected, the room was empty. She left the note on the table. A small page-boy was waiting outside her own door when she returned to it.
"Telegram for you, miss."
Tuppence took it from the salver and tore it open carelessly. Then she gave a cry. The telegram was from Tommy. Chapter 16. Further Adventures of Tommy. From a darkness punctuated with throbbing stabs of fire, Tommy dragged his senses slowly back to life. When he at last opened his eyes, he was conscious of nothing but an excruciating pain through his temples. He was vaguely aware of unfamiliar surroundings. Where was he? What had happened? He blinked feebly. This was not his bedroom at the Ritz. And what the devil was the matter with his head? "Damn!" said Tommy, and tried to sit up. He had remembered he was in that sinister house in Soho. He uttered a groan and fell back. Through his almost closed lids he reconnoitred carefully.
"He is coming too,"
remarked a voice very near Tommy's ear. He recognized it at once for that of the bearded and efficient German, and lay artistically inert. He felt that it would be a pity to come round too soon, and until the pain in his head became a little less acute, he felt quite incapable of collecting his wits. Painfully, he tried to puzzle out what had happened. Obviously, somebody must have crept up behind him as he listened, and struck him down with a blow on the head. They knew him now for a spy, and would in all probability give him short shrift. Undoubtedly, he was in a tight place. Nobody knew where he was, therefore he need expect no outside assistance, and must depend solely on his own wits.
"Well, here goes,"
murmured Tommy to himself, and repeated his former remark.
"Damn,"
he observed, and this time succeeded in sitting up. In a minute the German stepped forward and placed a glass to his lips with the brief command, "Drink." Tommy obeyed. The potency of the draught made him choke, but it cleared his brain in a marvellous manner. He was lying on a couch in the room in which the meeting had been held. On one side of him was the German, on the other the villainous-faced doorkeeper who had let him in. The others were grouped together at a little distance away. But Tommy missed one face. The man known as Number One was no longer of the company.
"Feel better?"
asked the German as he removed the empty glass.
"Yes, thanks,"
returned Tommy cheerfully.
"Ach, my young friend, it is lucky for you your skull is so thick. The good Conrad struck hard."
He indicated the evil-faced doorkeeper by a nod. The man grinned. Tommy twisted his head round with an effort.
"Oh," he said, "so you're Conrad, are you? Strikes me the thickness of my skull was lucky for you, too. When I look at you, I feel it's almost a pity I've enabled you to cheat the hangman."
The man snarled, and the bearded man said quietly,
"He would have run no risk of that." "Just as you like," replied Tommy. "I know it's the fashion to run down the police. I rather believe in them myself."
His manner was nonchalant to the last degree. Tommy Beresford was one of those young Englishmen, not distinguished by any special intellectual ability, but who are emphatically at their best in what is known as a tight place. Their natural diffidence and caution fall from them then like a glove. Tommy realized perfectly that in his own wits lay the only chance of escape, and behind his casual manner he was racking his brains furiously. The cold accents of the German took up the conversation.
"Have you anything to say before you are put to death as a spy?"
"Simply lots of things," replied Tommy, with the same urbanity as before.
"Do you deny that you were listening at the door?"
"I do not. I must really apologize, but your conversation was so interesting that it overcame my scruples."
"How did you get in?"
"Dear old Conrad here."
Tommy smiled deprecatingly at him.
"I hesitate to suggest pensioning off a faithful servant, but you really ought to have a better watchdog."
Conrad snarled impotently, and said sullenly, as the man with the beard swung round upon him,
"He gave the word, how was I to know?"
"Yes," Tommy chimed in, "how was he to know? Don't blame the poor fellow. His hasty action has given me the pleasure of seeing you all face to face."
He fancied that his words caused some discomposure among the group, but the watchful German stilled it with a wave of his hand.
"Dead men tell no tales," he said evenly.
"Ah," said Tommy, "but I'm not dead yet."
"You soon will be, my young friend," said the German.
An assenting murmur came from the others. Tommy's heart beat faster, but his casual pleasantness did not waver.
"I think not," he said firmly. "I should have a great objection to dying." He had got them puzzled. He saw that by the look on his captor's face.
"Can you give us any reason why we should not put you to death?" asked the German.
"Several," replied Tommy. "Look here, you've been asking me a lot of questions. Let me ask you one for a change. Why didn't you kill me off at once before I regained consciousness?"
The German hesitated, and Tommy seized his advantage.
"Because you didn't know how much I knew, and where I obtained that knowledge. If you kill me now, you never will know."
But here the emotions of Boris became too much for him. He stepped forward, waving his arms.
"You hellhound of a spy!" he screamed. "We will give you short shrift! Kill him! Kill him!"
There was a roar of applause.
"You hear?" said the German, his eyes on Tommy. "What have you to say to that?"
"Say?" Tommy shrugged his shoulders. "Pack of fools! Let them ask themselves a few questions. How did I get into this place? Remember what dear old Conrad said? With your own password, wasn't it? How did I get hold of that? You don't suppose I came up those steps haphazard and said the first thing that came into my head?"
Tommy was pleased with the concluding words of this speech. His only regret was that Tuppence was not present to appreciate its full flavour.
"That is true," said the working man suddenly. "Comrades, we've been betrayed."
An ugly murmur arose. Tommy smiled at them encouragingly.
"That's better. How can you hope to make a success of any job if you don't use your brains?"
"You will tell us who has betrayed us," said the German. "But that shall not save you. Oh, no. You shall tell us all that you know. Boris here knows pretty ways of making people speak."
"Pah!" said Tommy scornfully, fighting down a singularly unpleasant feeling in the pit of his stomach. "You will neither torture me nor kill me."
"And why not?" asked Boris.
"Because you'd kill the goose that lays the golden eggs," replied Tommy quietly.
There was a momentary pause. It seemed as though Tommy's persistent assurance was at last conquering. They were no longer completely sure of themselves. The man in the shabby clothes stared at Tommy searchingly.
"He's bluffing you, Boris," he said quietly.
Tommy hated him. Had the man seen through him? The German, with an effort, turned roughly to Tommy.
"What do you mean?"
"What do you think I mean?"
parried Tommy, searching desperately in his own mind. Suddenly Boris stepped forward and shook his fist in Tommy's face.
"Speak, you swine of an Englishman, speak!"
"Don't get so excited, my good fellow," said Tommy calmly. "That's the worst of you foreigners. You can't keep calm. Now I ask you, do I look as though I thought there were the least chance of your killing me?"
He looked confidently round, and was glad they could not hear the persistent beating of his heart, which gave the lie to his words.
"No," admitted Boris at last, sullenly, "you do not."
"Thank God he's not a mind-reader," thought Tommy. Aloud, he pursued his advantage.
"And why am I so confident? Because I know something that puts me in a position to propose a bargain."
"A bargain?"
The bearded man took him up sharply.
"Yes, a bargain. My life and liberty against..."
He paused.
"Against what?"
The group pressed forward. You could have heard a pin drop. Slowly, Tommy spoke.
"The papers that Danvers brought over from America in the Lusitania."
The effect of his words was electrical. Everyone was on his feet. The German waved them back. He leaned over Tommy, his face purple with excitement.
"Himmel! You have got them, then?"
With magnificent calm, Tommy shook his head.
"Do you know where they are?"
persisted the German. Again Tommy shook his head.
"Not in the least."
Then...
Angry and baffled, the words failed him. Tommy looked round. He saw anger and bewilderment on every face, but his calm assurance had done its work. No one doubted but that something lay behind his words.
"I don't know where the papers are, but I believe that I can find them. I have a theory."
"Pah!"
Tommy raised his hand and silenced the clamours of disgust.
"I call it a theory, but I'm pretty sure of my facts. Facts that are known to no one but myself. In any case, what do you lose? If I can produce the papers, you give me my life and liberty in exchange. Is it a bargain?"
"And if we refuse?" said the German quietly.
Tommy lay back on the couch.
"The 29th, he said thoughtfully, "is less than a fortnight ahead."
For a moment the German hesitated. Then he made a sign to Conrad.
"Take him into the other room."
For 5 minutes Tommy sat on the bed in the dingy room next door. His heart was beating violently. He had risked all on this throw. How would they decide? And all the while that this agonized questioning went on within him, he talked flippantly to Conrad, enraging the cross-grained doorkeeper to the point of homicidal mania. At last the door opened, and the German called imperiously to Conrad to return.
"Let's hope the judge hasn't put his black cap on," remarked Tommy frivolously.
"That's right, Conrad, march me in. The prisoner is at the bar, gentlemen."
The German was seated once more behind the table. He motioned to Tommy to sit down opposite to him.
"We accept," he said harshly, "on terms. The papers must be delivered to us before you go free."
"Idiot," said Tommy amiably. "How do you think I can look for them if you keep me tied by the leg here?"
"What do you expect, then?"
"I must have liberty to go about the business in my own way."
The German laughed.
"Do you think we are little children to let you walk out of here leaving us a pretty story full of promises?"
"No," said Tommy thoughtfully. "Though infinitely simpler for me, I did not really think you would agree to that plan. Very well, we must arrange a compromise. How would it be if you attached little Conrad here to my person? He's a faithful fellow and very ready with his fist."
"We prefer," said the German coldly, "that you should remain here. One of our number will carry out your instructions minutely. If the operations are complicated, he will return to you with a report, and you can instruct him further."
"You're tying my hands," complained Tommy. "It's a very delicate affair, and the other fellow will muff it up as likely as not, and then where shall I be? I don't believe one of you has got an ounce of tact."
The German rapped the table.
"Those are our terms. Otherwise, death."
Tommy leaned back wearily.
"I like your style. Curt, but attractive. So be it, then. But one thing is essential. I must see the girl."
"What girl?"
"Jane Finn, of course."
The other looked at him curiously for some minutes. Then he said slowly, and as though choosing his words with care,
"Do you not know that she can tell you nothing?"
Tommy's heart beat a little faster. Would he succeed in coming face to face with the girl he was seeking?
"I shall not ask her to tell me anything," he said quietly. "Not in so many words, that is."
"Then why see her?"
Tommy paused.
"To watch her face when I ask her one question," he replied at last.
Again there was a look in the German's eyes that Tommy did not quite understand.
"She will not be able to answer your question."
"That does not matter. I shall have seen her face when I ask it."
"And you think that will tell you anything?"
He gave a short, disagreeable laugh. More than ever, Tommy felt that there was a factor somewhere that he did not understand. The German looked at him searchingly.
"I wonder whether, after all, you know as much as we think," he said softly.
Tommy felt his ascendancy less sure than a moment before. His hold had slipped a little. But he was puzzled. What had he said wrong? He spoke out on the impulse of the moment.
"There may be things that you know which I do not. I've not pretended to be aware of all the details of your show. But equally, I've got something up my sleeve that you don't know about, and that's where I mean to score. Danvers was a damned clever fellow."
He broke off as if he had said too much. But the German's face had lightened a little.
"Danvers," he murmured. "I see."
He paused a minute, then waved to Conrad.
"Take him away. Upstairs, you know."
"Wait a minute," said Tommy. "What about the girl?"
"That may perhaps be arranged."
"It must be.
We will see about it. Only one person can decide that."
"Who?"
asked Tommy. But he knew the answer.
"Mr. Brown. Shall I see him?"
"Perhaps."
"Come,"
said Conrad harshly. Tommy rose obediently. Outside the door, his jailer motioned to him to mount the stairs. He himself followed close behind. On the floor above, Conrad opened a door and Tommy passed into a small room. Conrad lit a hissing gas burner and went out. Tommy heard the sound of the key being turned in the lock. He set to work to examine his prison. It was a smaller room than the one downstairs, and there was something peculiarly airless about the atmosphere of it. Then he realized that there was no window. He walked round it. The walls were filthily dirty, as everywhere else. Four pictures hung crookedly on the wall, representing scenes from Faust. Marguerite with her box of jewels, the church scene, Siebel and his flowers, and Faust and Mephistopheles. The latter brought Tommy's mind back to Mr. Brown again. In this sealed and closed chamber, with its close-fitting, heavy door, he felt cut off from the world, and the sinister power of the arch-criminal seemed more real. Shout as he would, no one could ever hear him. The place was a living tomb. With an effort, Tommy pulled himself together. He sank onto the bed and gave himself up to reflection. His head ached badly. Also, he was hungry. The silence of the place was dispiriting. "Anyway," said Tommy, trying to cheer himself, "I shall see the chief, the mysterious Mr. Brown, and with a bit of luck in bluffing, I shall see the mysterious Jane Finn also. After that..." After that, Tommy was forced to admit, the prospect looked dreary.